This is the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast for April 28th, 2020. Welcome to the Everybody's Talking at Once podcast. My name is Drew Messenger Michaels. I'm real glad you're here, and the world is still real crazy, so let's settle in for another good interview, shall we? Today I'm talking to Timon Teo of the Sock Pop Collective, who, if you're not familiar, are a group of four game developers based in the Netherlands who put out a small experimental indie game every 2 weeks. You can subscribe and get them as they come out, you can buy them individually. It's a sort of unusual way of funding game development and of putting games out there. We talk a bit about what that model asks of them as developers, what it asks of the audience, the sort of trust-based mode in which they work and operate, and of course we do talk a fair bit about the games themselves, especially about Featherfall. If you're familiar with that sock pop creation, that's one of Timon's. I think it's great. I should note, the audio is a bit rougher than usual in places, but I have done my best to make it listenable, and I think that it is. And it's worth it in any case, because this is a good talk, if I do say so myself. As such, enjoy. Hello. Thank you a ton for taking the time. You don't do a ton of podcasty type interviews, maybe because, we can talk about why, but my impression is because you guys have such a sort of like curated media presence already, you don't really have to. So that, like, for that reason, I'm all the more excited that you took the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, there's not a real reason why we do or don't. Mostly it's because we don't really have the time, and we also sometimes, you know, find it a bit scary to talk to all these people.
Sure. Because you don't know what you're getting into, or just because, again, you don't like have control of the narrative.
Yeah, I guess last thing.
Yeah, fair enough.
We are really good just sitting behind a computer and doing our own thing alone.
Well, I mean, that's true and that's not true, right? So, like, let's start at the beginning. For anybody who isn't familiar, what exactly is Sock Pop?
So we are a collective of four guys. We all make games. We do it all individually. So each one of us does programming and design and art and audio. And what we do at Sock Pop is we have a subscription model type of thing on Patreon, where we release two games every month, and so subscribers get two brand new games every month, and they are usually quite short, like between a few minutes to an hour playtime. However, a few of them might go over that. Some of them you can play for hours, and they're also usually a bit experimental.
Definitely. And it's, I mean, so full disclosure, I am a $3 level Patreon.
All right.
I have a great time with it. My wife really enjoys it too. The first one she locked into was Llamavilla or Llamavilla, which I think a lot of people, a breakout one for you, but she really likes Cappy Hockey. She really liked Pupper Park. Yeah. The extra cute ones tend to be her favorites. But she's also really been enjoying Sock Worlds, the new one that's just sort of like a 3D place creation tool. So she's definitely a fan as well. We more than feel like we get our $3 worth, because part of what's amazing about the model is, I think you've said this in interviews or somebody from the collective has, even if something comes out and you just really don't like it or it's not your thing, like, A, you're still supporting experimentation and it's probably interesting, even if it's not your very favorite thing in the world. And then B, you're getting something else in 2 weeks. So it's, you know, the commitment is very, very low in that sense.
Yeah, exactly. We've seen a lot of people that were like, oh, I don't like this particular type of thing, even though, you know, some people might find the idea cool, but they just don't like playing that kind of stuff. And they're always looking forward to what the next thing will be, and we generally don't make the same types of games too many times in a row, because that's kind of boring.
Right. It is remarkable what variety there is, even though, I mean, so you refer to yourselves as a collective, and we should talk a little bit about sort of like the economics of it and all that, because you are like a real deal collective. But I've also heard you refer to yourselves as an indie game boy band, which is true in the sense that you're four, you know, photogenic young dudes making pop art, but also in the sense that you can sort of like that you sort of do have your, you know, in the same way that a boy band has like the cute one, the mature one, whatever.
Right.
Your games do sort of have the individual characters. Like I think of your specific ones like Dolor, Featherfall, as being sort of the, you know, like when the dark, a bit more systemic, a bit more brooding jams come out, I'm like, oh, that's, you know, that's a Timon game or something like that, right? That's not true across the board. There is variety among all of your output. But I do think something else it invites you to do, especially with the little intro videos where you talk about the games as they come out, it does sort of invite someone who wants to, you know, contribute to lock into your personalities and your sensibilities and all that.
Right. Yeah. So that was the whole point why we did the videos, because we noticed that a lot of people aren't just in for the games, but they also like seeing what we do and like us as people. And that's actually very interesting, because I think you can see that throughout in how people play video games nowadays, where, I mean, I'm not sure if that's true for everyone, but for me personally, when I was young and I would play a game, I would just know a game, like, oh, I have this particular game on the Super NES or whatever, and I like that one, and I have no idea who made that game. But you see right now, like, you know about a lot of developers, and you know stuff about this person, even though you don't really know what that person is like. You know, you have Toby Fox that made Undertale. And I remember we're talking about, is this a real person? And there were all these rumors about how it actually might be a fake person, and there was a whole team behind it or whatever.
Yeah, no, it's like it's like the Shakespeare multiple authorship theories or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because, like, you know, the question is Toby Fox a real person? The answer is, of course, kinda, because Toby Fox is a persona, right? You're real name or not, you're always putting a persona out there. And I think, you know, I think I was in your lane too when I was a kid, a little kid especially. Like, I, you know, games may as well have sprung fully formed from the earth. I had no idea where they came from or how they were made. Then as I got older, I probably again had a pretty common experience of lionizing a few really big AAA developers. You know, like, I knew who Shigeru Miyamoto was. I knew who Tim Schafer was, you know, like that. I think now we're in this new phase where some indie developers are essentially social media celebrities. But more to the point, people are very aware that humans make games. And there's something really liberating about that, of course, because if just a person makes a game, then so can I, you know, like if I develop the skill set.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, to me, it's more tied into what the music industry also is, for example, where I like certain types of music, but I'm also invested in this persona of the artist, and I want to know stuff about that person, even though that has nothing to do with the music.
totally.
Well, I think you enjoy the music more. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. No, because it's so personal. I think that's what's so interesting. I think you said in an interview one time that, you know, making games is extremely personal. I think, I'm sorry to quote you to yourself, but I thought it was a really good sentiment that I wanted to talk to you about, which was that you wouldn't write a book with 100 people, because then it's not your story anymore, right? So in the same way that, you know, a band makes an album or a person makes a solo album or something like that, I think there's a dawning awareness that especially with smaller scale, more experimental indie games, they can be these really personal experiences where the person's personality, and maybe even more to the point, your understanding of the person's personality, of their persona, is all wrapped up in how you experience the game, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't know you, but I have a sense of you from the games that you played. And I know, I'm sure that's super weird, but it's also definitely part of the point of the way you guys put stuff out, I think.
But to me, it's very fun. I mean, you've been around since Lama Vida, you said, right? So that's been a while. Mm-hmm. So you've been around for a while. And I've heard another patron who's been there from the start. At some point, I think I released Ulysses or something, and they did a tweet where they quoted me out of the video, like, oh, it's a management type of game, and I don't remember what I said exactly, something about management. He was like, oh, that's probably a timing game. I was like, what, is that me? Is that so? But that was really fun to see that people are having fun exploring what we do and seeing our style.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we haven't said, you do definitely have a house style. So like there is a big variety in sort of the genres of games and sort of the visual sense that they present, but they are all, I think quite remarkably, they're all instantly recognizable as sock pop games.
No, yeah, definitely. We worked together for years doing game jams side by side and, you know, doing other types of projects. So we learned how to make games for a big part through each other. And that's how we developed the same style, which first was kind of a joke to us, like, oh, I'm going to put Tom's little dude in my game. We would laugh about it. And then later we found out like, oh, man, this is actually really good for people to recognize our house style.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, so it's a really smart style in a bunch of ways. Number one, it's super recognizable and it's something you're all clearly comfortable working in. It's visually appealing and cute. It's but then like it's also, it's not always cute, I suppose, but it's often cute. It's appealing, right? And that's maybe the better word. But it's also, it occurs to me, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to point this out, and I'm sure it's very intentional, but it's a style that lets you iterate really quickly. It gives it a lot of personality, definitely. Procedural animations and low polys. Yeah, all of that. So like it's recognizable as you, and it's got a ton of pop, but you don't have to labor over like, you know, super realistic models or animations or whatever, which you couldn't do in the amount of time you give yourselves to make games.
Yeah, you're totally right. It's low effort. Good stuff.
Well, low effort good stuff is 100% necessary if you're going to put out as much stuff as you guys put out, right? Like it's, I think you even another thing you've said previously is that you way underestimated the amount of time it was going to take to make a game, and you sort of planned ahead. You had a buffer of 8 games for if you didn't make deadlines, but which you've burned through for quite a while. But it's like I think you've probably gotten better at, I mean, like with any game, right? Like overscoping or scope creep is a huge problem. This is like that, you know, hyper nightmare mode in terms of not allowing that to happen, right?
Well, you're right, but scoping is it's always how much you want to do relatively to how much time you have. And people would say, "Oh, a game every 2 weeks or a game every month." That's a lot. But then also it isn't, because a lot of people do game jams where you make a game in 2 days. So people know that that's possible. And that's how we figured it. Like, oh, we always do game jams. That's 2 days. So if we just take 2 weeks extra, we'll have a really big game. Which isn't the case. But
you could think of it as a very, very tiny indie game, or you could think of it as an incredibly polished jam game. Right? Either way, kind of makes
exactly.
sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how we viewed it. But I think it's so you enlarge the scope because you realize you have more time. And that's why we ran through our buffer so fast, because we knew that we had so much time and we would make bigger games, or we would start from scratch after a week or 2 weeks in, because you're like, well, we still have all this time left. And you always end up pushing that deadline, whether you decide to make a game in 2 days or you decide to make it in 2 weeks or even a year, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that process is inevitable. You can't completely avoid it, but you can at least like radically shorten the cycles between I have this idea, well, should this be part of it or should it be its own thing? I can't remember which one of the four of you said it, but someone said like maybe a bad idea always has something good in it. So like something that isn't going the way you think it is, there's still some kernel in there that could absolutely sustain, you know, a 1 hour experience or something.
Yeah, definitely. To me, that's a part of game design in which you can learn to be good at, if that makes sense. It's a very simple thing.
It's a learnable skill, unlike like creativity more generally, which is sort of, where does that even come from? This is something you can practice and get better at.
Yeah, definitely. And you have to do that by talking to people and be really reflective about what did I make, and did I enjoy it, or did other people enjoy it, or what specifically did they enjoy or not? And people will never be honest about what they find enjoying or not. So that's
I'm sure it's honesty sometimes, but it's also like self-awareeness, right? Sometimes people don't really know which part is actually making them enjoy it. Yeah
So you kind of have to learn how to tell what makes people put down a controller or say let's go for another round or whatever, you know. And then you can find out which things are working and other things that aren't. A cool anecdote about it is that I once made a game, and it was a grid-based game, basically, for a big part. And the grid size, the tile set, was 16 by 16 pixels. And then that was, at first it was small, it was like 8x8. Then we did a whole new art. It was sort of the tile, so it became 16x16. And then after a while, I noticed people didn't like playing the game anymore. And at, so at that point, a lot changed, not just the grid size. And then I just changed the tile set from 16x16 to 12x12. And all of a sudden, people started enjoying the game again. And I was like, huh, that's so weird. Because that's not something you would ever figure out from their feedback.
No, I don't think even a really experienced game developer would say, would give you that piece of feedback, right? Like, it's, yeah, that's fascinating. That's, do you so have any weird sense of why that change had the effect that it did?
Yeah, so it was a platformer where you picked up blocks and you would throw them. But if you were standing on a block and you would pick up that block, you would fall. So the whole, because the blocks were so big, if you would pick it up and you were standing on it, you would always fall.
You made a giant hole for yourself, basically.
Yeah, and I made the block smaller. So if you would pick up one, you would always still be standing on another. So people wouldn't kill themselves as fast. Yeah.
And, but that's so interesting, because you may have gotten the feedback. I don't know if you did, but you could imagine someone giving you the feedback of, oh, it's way too easy to put myself in a fail state or something.
Yeah, and I was but that was always the case.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's so interesting. I've talked to Zach Barth from Zachtronics a bunch of times on the show, and one thing he said is that when you're playtesting, you always want to listen when a player tells you what a problem is, and you never want to listen when they offer a solution, because they generally don't know what the fix should be. That's kind of an extreme position, but this might be an example of that, right? Like, like you had a very left field solution to a problem that was obvious, but the solution was not obvious.
Wasn't, yeah, definitely. And there were probably a bunch of other solutions as well. I think I agree. I've seen a lot of people that didn't end up designing their game well usually don't listen to feedback, but instead would defend their own decisions. If someone's like, oh, I don't like this, they would say, well, you should like it because that's an oversimplified version.
That's poison in any artistic medium, I think. This is not to beat up on a specific example, but I just remember so well back when Braid came out. Braid has suddenly been coming up a lot on this podcast. I don't know why. But I remember Jonathan Blow would jump in on forums when people would come up with their interpretation of the story or say, here's my theory, and say, well, no, that's wrong, and here's what it actually means and things like that. And it was an interesting spectacle, right? Because I think his thinking may have evolved on this. I've never gotten him on the show, maybe someday. But I think he used to think of games as meaning machines. You know what I mean? Like, you put in the input, and if you've made it perfectly, people get out exactly what you put in. And it was frustrating to see people interpret things differently. I would imagine that, especially making things really quickly, you don't have that notion at all, right? Like, you know that people's reactions are going to be personal and different. And I think you've said before, you don't necessarily know which games are going to resonate with people and which aren't. Mm-hmm. Similand was a game that you thought was no good that then blew up completely, for example.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so actually with Similand and what I did, the game was bad. After 3 or 4 weeks in, the game was super bad. But what I did was I just play tested it a bunch, basically. We work in an office space with a lot of our friends that also either make games or do something along the lines of, some of them make do graphics for a bunch of stuff, or doesn't really matter. Anyways, we rent this office space together. So what I did was I let them play the game, and I would just see which things they'd enjoy, which things they didn't, the usual stuff, write it all down. And then later, try to decompile all my notes and work it into the game. And I think that's how it ended up being a better game. And for most of the games I made for the Patreon, whenever I would do that, like playtest a bunch, kind of try to do something with that feedback, the game would be better.
Do you still find that there is some feedback that you sort of need to not ignore, but reinterpret, right? Like, is there feedback that have you developed an instinct for not taking certain feedback at face value? Since we've been saying, people don't necessarily know why they're having a good time, right? They know whether they're having a good time, but maybe not why.
I'm not sure what you mean, but
Well, sure. I mean, like, Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm not sure what I mean either. I guess just like it's very, because I guess let me take a step back. I'm in awe of how many interesting ideas you guys put out and how quickly it seems from the outside you must get to what's interesting about an idea, like Unices, right? Like it's just like it's a really it you know, right into trade and piracy and whatever, like it locks right in. Featherfall like manages to like be exactly like it hits all the points of a Souls like in like so quickly, so ridiculously quickly. So it's like when you're figuring out whether you're hitting those points, you know, how much of it is just trusting your gut and how much of it is like,
right.
How often is it about confirming things you suspect might be right or wrong with it versus being open? I don't know. It's a strange question because I'm sure it's a little bit of an intuitive process. They're like more art than science.
Yeah, that's hard. Yeah. So I guess what I did for Featherfall is interesting because I never liked Dark Souls games. I tried it a bunch of times when I was younger and I just really didn't understand the appeal. And then later I gave it another go with some friends. They were pushing me to try it and we were all together and I was like, all right, I'll go play it. And I really, really put in effort to give it a chance. And at some point I did start liking it. So obviously I would question myself, like, why did I think this was lame? And now I'm enjoying it. What specific things are making the difference, or what is it that I enjoy now that I didn't before? And I try to filter out that stuff and put it in Featherfall because that's what I enjoyed about the Souls likes in the end.
You tried to hone in on stuff like stamina management and like, you know, mazy level design and weird items and things like that, and then cut all the stuff that was frustrating. Yeah,
I guess so. Finding all these upgrades is really cool. I think what I enjoyed was walking around and finding a new passage to a new part. And there's a cool boss fight. And like, oh shit, you can figure out that boss fight if you just try to understand what the other is doing. And then when you finally do it, you get something cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
totally
kind of that feel.
Well, that's what sock pop games are, I think, so good at. In general is locking into what's actually interesting about maybe a specific series or a genre or something like that. I mean, to go all the way back to Llama Villa, you know, it's, besides the fact that it's llamas and llamas are cool, like it distills The Sims down to basically one screen. You're doing everything cool about The Sims, but you're doing it in a very compact way. Similarly, Featherfall is
more
like exactly. Or Pear Quest is another example of like it does what a short hike does, kinda, or maybe right. A more involved exploration game, but like on a single image. Like it's distillation. That's what you guys force yourself to do. And I think you're really good at it. Featherfall is such a good example of that, where it's pure discovery, exploration, menace. You get the fear down. You get the like slightly wonky combat with big windups in there. but none of the stuff that would be A, expensive, and B, maybe less core to what makes Souls design interesting, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because like I could believe just looking at it quickly that it was made by someone who at least initially didn't like the Souls games, because it's almost like a parody. You know, you've got like birds and you know, all that stuff.
It was a blob, and the blob didn't look very good. It had a beak, and then it looks a lot better. Like, let's run with beaks.
Yeah. And then, so that's a great example, right? So you made it a blob, but then you gave it a beak, and then it became a bird-themed world just because now we have a bird. That's great. That's an awesome example of being like free with those ideas. And the bird has one of your classic sock pop walk cycles, which is really, really fun and delightful to look at. I think you've said that you do the procedural walking from scratch every time, so it's never quite the same twice. Is that true?
Yeah. Yes, that is true. A bunch of people have asked us like, you probably have some kind of library to reuse stuff, and that's why you have this walk. These funny walks, and it all makes sense now. We're like, we totally have a library.
I think all four of you have said it at various times that you reuse less stuff than one would think, maybe even less than you should on some level.
Yeah.
But you do a lot of stuff from scratch for every game.
Yeah, no, that last thing is totally right. We should reuse more stuff than we know.
Well, is it fair to ask then why you don't, even this far in?
Okay, so because we have to make the game so quickly, our code isn't always very reusable.
Sure. Okay, I see what you're saying. You're not creating a polished library of assets. You're just making it work in one context and then moving on.
It's getting worse you're near your deadline. You're like, oh shit, I can still cram in a bunch of content now in the next few hours if I just, you know, just do it. Just make exceptions everywhere.
Sure. Yeah. It's all exception, no rule, which is why it's not a stable library. That makes a ton of sense. And it also makes sense, something else I believe you've said, which is that what you reuse are ideas or techniques. You learn how to do stuff and then you do those things again, but you do them from scratch each time. And that makes total sense to know that you probably do them better next time than you did last time or more efficiently or something.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Because you understand the concept. So then you just have to do it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, so besides you putting out great games and besides it, you know, it being an interesting sustainable economic model, which I do want to get to in a sec, and how sustainable you feel like it is and all of that. It's also like, what an incredible masterclass you're giving yourselves, like that you have this sort of sustainable way to build all this stuff from scratch and explore any genre you're interested in. I mean, like, this is why people love game jams, but the idea that you're, I mean, like I a couple episodes ago, I spoke to Arvi Teyakari, who made Baba Is You. And that's in a sense, the more traditional way to sort of fund one's game development, right? Like, not that everyone can do it, but it's what people think of as the indie story, where he just makes tons and tons of stuff. One idea really hit and he spent a long ass time making a very, you know, big polished release. And while he did that, he did a bunch of other, you know, jam games on the side, right? You guys still make bigger projects, but you sort of have the flip of that, right? Like, the bread and butter is the smaller stuff. And that's, that was somewhat by design, right? Like, you realized you liked making jam games and you could work quickly and all that. And you wanted to find a way to make that your jobs or make it sustainable. Is that, is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah, it totally is. I think a lot of other developers, feel that as well, that what you want to do is make all your ideas, right? That's why you got into game development in the first place. It's just really fun to think of something like, oh man, I wish this game would exist, and then you can just do it. But when you end up in a big project, usually a lot of people at some point want to have side projects again because of that. So yeah, that's what we wanted to do. Just keep making small experimental stuff. We just had to figure out a way how we could still eat.
So let's, I mean, if I may, because you are the CFO, right, of Sock Puppet. Let's talk about how you guys get food. So you are a collective, right? Like, it's a pretty flat structure. And my understanding, this may be outdated information because it's from your GDC talk, 2 GDCs ago, the last, I guess, the most recent physical GDC. But you split the Patreon and itch.io income after you pay into office rent. And then for projects that are not Patreon games, the deal is that at least 5% of what the developer makes goes to the collective for events and merch and stuff like that. And the rest of it's sort of discretionary. Is that still basically how it works?
Yeah, that's still how it works. To us, it's a good model. We actually thought a lot about what being a collective would mean financially, which was very hard to do because it was all speculation, like how we would get money in the first place.
Sure.
But yeah, most of those rules were altered or came to be after we started getting money at all. And I think a lot of people warn you about collaborating with someone, like starting a company with someone. They would say, oh, you really need to write down perfect rules on how you're going to split all the income together. Because if you don't, you're going to get into a fight. And then you go, I don't know, the company will, what do you call that?
we'll go bankrupt or we'll dissolve or something. I mean, a lot of that advice boils down to don't trust people too much, right? Like in the US, people always say,
don't trust them. Yeah.
No money in the family or something, right? Like don't do financial business with people you want to have like a sustained emotional relationship with.
Yeah. But we didn't do that. We
did. Sure.
We didn't set up rules and people would warn us like, oh, you should definitely make up some rules. So we actually did try it, but we found out that the rules you have heavily depend on what your situation is. So we decided that we would just trust each other. If it doesn't work, if you get in a fight because of the money, then maybe it's just not working and we just shouldn't do it, you know? And if it does work, then it's worth the risk. So that's kind of how we stepped into it. Just trusting each other's abilities and intent. And then when we did get some money, we just talked about it. At first, it was just, we should just split everything. And then I think Similand began to sell more, like significantly more at that point. I think it made about 10K in a week. Mm.
And for reference, what was the Patreon at that time? It was like...
The Patreon was like maybe 2K a month. Yeah, that was like all we had. We were doing a lot of other side jobs to be able to go by, you know? Mm-hmm. So we sat down and we talked and I was like, well, so I made Similand at that point, but I did it for the Patreon. So we decided that the money it got up to that point, which we should just split that because we were all making stuff for the Patreon, putting in the same effort. And what comes out of it is a product of our combined effort.
Sure.
So that's why we split it. Then we decided, well, if I were to do something more with that gain, it would not be for the Patreon anymore. So then just a small percentage would go back into Sockpile because we invest in each other or want to invest in each other.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect sense. Yeah. I mean, it still involves a lot of trust, right? Because it's the minimum 5% or whatever. Still, you know, someone could say, well, I'm only going to pay the minimum or something. And it also, I suppose, doesn't necessarily follow that the game you put the most effort into is the one that's going to break out the way Similand kind of did, right? Like, that's the balance with any kind of collective is being fair and being sustainable and splitting equitably while still making room for something, you know, some project to take on a life of its own and become bigger than whatever the group is working on together.
Yeah.
Yeah, because the plan would not be for all four of you to then have to pivot to working on Similand a day a week or something, right? Like, that's not really the model. So, yeah. The plan was always, if I'm not mistaken, not just to keep freelancing, but to always make bigger games, you know, like with some of the time that you would have because the Patreon was your bread and butter.
Yeah, that's the dream.
It's been a reality to a certain degree, right? You have released some bigger stuff.
Yeah. So actually at first we did decide that if one of the games would be something successful, we could like ring a bell or something and talk collective mode on and everyone would have to work on that game, but obviously
interesting.
Yeah, it was a cool idea, but it doesn't really work. We actually thought of a lot of these dumb ideas, like how
so I think I have a sense of why that wouldn't work. I mean, because especially because you're building stuff quickly and the code is really quirky and like just the from a project methodology standpoint, the knowledge transfer of all the crazy shit you did to make the game work, getting three people up to speed on that probably isn't worth it. Is that the main reason that didn't work, or was it also just that you didn't want to assume the other three guys have the same passion for the idea that you do?
Yeah, I actually think it's more of the latter because you could also just start from scratch, you know. So that's not really
sure.
It just feels like you're not doing the thing that you want anymore, but you're just doing something for someone else at that point.
Sure. It's sort of contrary to what was interesting about the idea in the first place. The idea of you're all kind of making jam scale games, you know, a bit more than that, but less than a commercial release. Right. The whole pitch, like you were saying, is that way you're always working on something you're excited about and passionate about. As soon as it's we move to whatever the market wants and I'll focus on that for a few months, that fundamentally changes that. Then you're just a studio as opposed to a collective or a boy band. Yeah.
That's what a lot of that's not what boy bands do.
Well, yeah, boy bands have no control over what they sing, no. You know. So it's a bad metaphor in that sense, but you know, it works in other ways.
So what we do now is we get our monthly income from doing Patreon games, which are basically prototypes, like polished prototypes, and then when we make a bigger game, like we did with Similand and a few others. That's all the money that comes in from those bigger games is money that we don't use to live off of. So that's something that we can use to build to a future. That's basically the idea.
Yeah, yeah. So can I ask about the future? Does the future look like continuing to do more or less what you're doing sustainably? Is there a bigger plan for how things could change? You know, what you do works so well, partly because of the scale at which you do it. But is there, you know, like a studio, if they were a studio that had been as successful as the Sock Pop Collective had been, would at least be thinking about scaling up? And I don't get the sense that that's really your plan. So is there a plan, or are you sort of taking it 1 month, one day, 1 year at a time?
Yeah, we're definitely, actually we are doing this a year at a time. That's how we did it in the start. But basically what we did say to each other is, let's do this Patreon idea for a year. It was just another of our dumb ideas at that point.
Sure. But
like, let's try it for a year. We were all agreeing, like, yeah, we could definitely try that for a year. And then at the end of the year, we'll evaluate if we should continue that. We did set a vague mark, like, if we make this amount of money a month by that time, then we'll continue or not. But obviously, that's always arguable or discussable.
Open to review. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And we still do that. We did that in our second year of the Patreon as well, where we said, well, let's do it for another year. It's going pretty well. And we'll review it at the end of the year again. And that's the same thing we're doing now. Although I can safely say that there's a big chance that we'll continue doing it for a while.
Sure. Well, it's become what you're known for. And yeah. It's from the outside, it sure looks like it's continued to grow and gain traction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So much fun. We are having so much fun making these small experimental things and being able to talk to our community, mostly through our Discord, just seeing how they find out about everything and are enjoying the games and, you know, asking stuff about the games to us. You know, I don't know. It's just, I really love doing that.
Yeah, totally, totally. The idea of this, of course, was to make it joyful, and I think maybe the idea wasn't necessarily initially to build a community, but that's for sure what's happened. I know the way you guys talked about it early on was definitely about making it sustainable to make games.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's, I don't just mean that financially, I mean it like emotionally, right? One of your big victories the first year, a couple of years, you said, was avoiding burnout, right? Do you still feel like that's the case? You know, is this model of game development a young person's game, and does it have a shelf life on it? Or do you feel like you've found a pace where you can keep doing this for the foreseeable future?
So I think on that topic, there are a few things that you could look at.
Sure.
Where to begin? I think let's see. So one thing you could think of is, what if we get older and we want to become, we want to have a family, each of our own, you know?
Sure.
That would be a big change. That's actually something I think about because I'm a bit older than the others. Like, what if in 5 years I'm going to be a dad, or, you know, how is this going to look by then? And that also means that it's that we are kind of living on the edge from a burnout view. Like, we are always pushing ourselves, and we could probably stretch 1 or 2 weeks after a deadline. Like, if I can't make a deadline, I could probably do it the week after. And if I really need to, I could do 2 weeks more. And in worst case, I could switch with someone. But we have a saying in Dutch that it rhymes, but it basically translates to, if you switch, you cry.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. We always say that because every time we do switch, it ends up being super hectic afterwards. Because we always have the schedule. So it's my turn now, but if I would switch, then that means the next time I make a game is really soon. And it's always a lot sooner than you anticipate for some reason. So yeah, it's really tight. It's a tight schedule. We didn't burn out yet. We've been going at it for more than 2 years. So I'm confident that we won't be. But I've always felt that it's pretty tight. And if there was a big change, like someone would get sick or someone would become a parent or anything along those lines, yeah, I don't really know how we would fix that. But I'm also kind of confident in our community that they will be able to support us if something like that would happen. I'm pretty sure, like, if I would get sick right now, that not all of our patrons would say, well...
Well, so much for this guy. So much for this. Yeah. I mean, I think you, one of the things you said in that GDC talk, you or Ruben said that in September of 2018, less than 50% of your patrons were actually downloading the games, which was bewildering at first, but the positive way to interpret that, and I think an accurate way to interpret that, is that people weren't just paying for the games. They wanted to support you guys and what you're doing. So yeah. In that sense, if, you know, if there did have to be an interruption of content or whatever, you can fully expect that a decent number of the people who support you would keep supporting you because they believe in what you're doing, you know, over and above getting two games a month.
Yeah. Right.
You mentioned getting sick. I do sort of have to, not that I'm not saying I know the four of you are not sick, but given the historical moment we're in, what, you know, we're talking on April 15th. It seems like core to your way of working was you talked about that shared working space where it's the sock pop folks and then some non-sock pop folks all working in an office. I assume you're not doing that right now.
No, we're working from home.
Yeah. Has that been a big change for you guys? And you know, I'll put the standard disclaimer on this, which is that having to work from home, being able to work from home is a privileged position. A lot of people are getting hit way harder right now. But I think it's still nonetheless strange and, you know, worth talking about. Has that messed with the way you guys work or collaborate at all? Or has it been relatively smooth as a transition?
I'd say relatively, yeah, it's probably pretty smooth. Mm-hmm. But I think the biggest issue that we have is that as a result we ended up we canceled our office space, so we have to be out before June. It's not only due to the pandemic, but it's partially due to it. We're getting a new office somewhere after the summer, August or September, probably September, which is a bigger place. It's a really nice place. But now we can't even make use of our current space, and we don't know for how long. And we also are pretty tight on the budget for the new office space because it's like a shared thing. It's not just our thing. We have to build a bunch of stuff for it as well. So sure. We decided to cancel the rent. But that would mean that I would have to stay home for at least a few months, which is, I mean, now it's fine because if I really need to, I can go to the office and start up the iMac to make a Mac build or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
But that's, we can't do that in the coming months probably. And it's a result because of the pandemic, but that's probably the biggest issue I have. So I would say, yeah, it's relatively smooth.
Yeah. I know, totally. As disruptions go, that's not too bad. I guess just thinking about, you know, listening to the way you talk about the way you collaborate, it seemed like, you know, being in the same room is not just preferable, but you would have said up front core to what you're doing that, you know, you wouldn't have started up Sock Pop with the expectation that everyone was working from home. Obviously right now is different, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so actually, now that you say that, I think another issue I've noticed is I have to release my Patreon game this week, and I'm having a bit of trouble with it because I haven't been able to playtest it on anyone because there's no one there.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's way more complicated to like make a build and send it out than to just say, hey, come over here and play this.
Yeah, exactly. And every time I make something for the Patreon, there are moments where I'm walking around in the office just mumbling to myself, like, I have this design problem, how am I going to fix it? And I always end up talking to someone in the office, and they'll help me either by being rubber duck or actually giving good ideas, you know? That's a part that I really miss, being able to talk to people about the design, but also the technical parts and like other stuff. So that's, it makes it harder to make the games.
Yeah. I think a lot about this, about how much of it is just what we're used to and how much of it is an inevitable problem. But like that kind of collaboration, just in my experience, never happens as well on a digital tool, be it Slack or Teams or whatever, there's no mm-hmm. replacement for just, you know, mumbling into your coffee or whatever and having someone say what's going on and then having a conversation. Like that kind of spontaneous, you know, a planned interaction, like a stand up or a meeting or whatever, you can absolutely do online. It has its challenges, whatever, but that spontaneous stuff does sort of require physical presence and like reading body language and all those things that you kind of can't do even in a video, you know?
Exactly. And you need to be friends with these people as well. You need to trust each other and like know each other. And there is, you need a lot of stuff to be able to find yourself in such a position. I think for that reason, I've always felt like super privileged to be able to do this. You know, I've needed a lot of stuff to even get there. Stuff that I wouldn't have been able to do without the help of other people. Like, help of my parents and help of friends, help of other game developers in the Netherlands that are super helpful in general.
Yeah. I get the sense that there is sort of a strong community in the Netherlands of developers and folks like that.
It's been better, but there's still a lot of good people, you know?
For sure. Can I ask about the fact that you guys are in the Netherlands real quick? Because I think... I'm curious of how, you know, how things feel there right now, because I think in the US everything's chaos. I get the sense that in the Netherlands it's not nearly as chaotic, but also like the existence of Sock Pop does have a bit to do with the fact that you're in the Netherlands. I think like in terms of government support for art creation, you guys have access to certain stuff that that's other people in the world, certainly in the US, don't, right? So like, is that... Mm-hmm. You know, obviously you're there because you're from there, but is it also, you know, like was it a conscious choice to stay in the Netherlands and of course it was. You live there already. You're not going to move if you don't have a really good reason to.
Yeah.
But it's like also there is something about the place where you are that makes what you do possible and sustainable and doable. Yeah.
So do you first want to know how things are here?
Yeah, that was a compound question. Sorry.
I guess things that we had that helped us out were, at some point we did, I think Tom got a grant that would help him develop Burn Ban. So that's something that's institutional, or is that how you say it?
Institutional, yeah.
Right. And we met each other in college. And you get a college monthly, I don't really know what these things are called in English. You basically, you get money from the government every month.
Like
called
grants or stipends. And
right.
In the US. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's a monthly thing. However, you borrow it. You do need to, it's a loan. That's the word I'm looking for.
Gotcha.
It is a loan. However, you don't need to pay it back if you can't, if that makes sense. There are a bunch of rules where it says that it basically means that you can only pay it back if you have the money to do so over the next 3 years or something. So it's like the loan you can have. Basically every student does it, and that's what makes your student time really doable over here. Also, college doesn't nearly cost as much in the US.
Yeah. Oh my, both of those aspects are very different than things are over here. Both the overall cost and the idea that, I mean, like student loan debt in the US, as I'm sure you're aware, will follow you past bankruptcy. It actually doesn't get canceled even if at some point you say, I have no money and I have to start from scratch. When you bounce back, you still have your same student loan debt.
Yeah, it's crazy. That being said, that has actually been a huge part for us. Or it's been very important for us because we experimented a lot in college, maybe in a different way.
You hear that phrase a lot, but I do know what you mean by it. Yeah,
I realize it now. Anyway, it's because we met each other. We talked a lot about what we want to do in the future. And at some point I was making a big game with more of a traditional studio type of like working behavior. And at some point I realized that that's not what I want to do. And I met all these people, and I met Tom and Aaron and Ruben, and we came up with the collective idea, but it didn't mean what it means now. So we had to figure that out. we made up all these dumb ideas about how we could make money in a cool way making games. Most of them we didn't try because they were just plain dumb, or we couldn't do it. One of them we tried was make an EP, which was inspired by EP albums, music albums.
Was this was this Bamboo EP?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so okay. small games in one thing that would be more integrated than just a folder with multiple small games in it.
And mini game compilations were a thing, like a huge thing, especially in the era of the original Wii and stuff, right? Like it was a known format.
Yeah, it does exist already, or it did exist already. But even still, we thought that would be a cool thing. Like we could do EPs or whatever, and that would be our thing. So we tried Bamboo EP and didn't work out. Like it was cool as in like an art project or whatever, but it wasn't financially viable. So I think we tried more of those things and those didn't work out as well. And basically what it means is that we experimented a lot, and what we found and do now works, but that's only because we did a bunch of stuff that didn't work, I think. And that's because we had space and time to try stuff.
It's probably absolutely key to say too, it works for you guys, right? Like I don't get the sense when you talk about this that you're saying this is the future of independent game development. Everyone should do this. It's just that you found a way of working that works for the way you work. That was a terrible sentence. Definitely. But you know what I mean? You know.
Yeah. you are right. This is perfect for us because we were used to doing this, and we were able to do this because we did all these other stuff before that we already talked about. Like the fact that we were already working together and we're joking about taking over each other's style and work ended up that we had a house style, which helped the whole patron because it comes forward more as a single thing. And there are so many of these things that would help. We also went to a lot of conventions in our early years. So we knew a lot of people already that essentially helped out with the kickoff of the Patreon, or they would write about our games because they already knew us. Yeah, I could just go on endlessly about how this was perfect for us.
Yeah. When it's something else you've talked about that, it occurs, you talked about how the model required the four of you to trust each other a lot, which against the advice of people who said, no, put it all in black and white so you don't have to trust it also requires trust between you and your audience. Like you said, like you trust that if someone gets sick, you're not necessarily going to lose your entire financial, support base. And they trust that you are, in fact, going to keep putting stuff out unless you have a very good reason not to, right? And like what maybe something you struggled with initially with the Patreon as it was growing slowly was gaining that trust, right? So it occurs to me how much this model is based on trust and how different that is from the suspicious to openly hostile relationship that audiences and game developers sometimes have, I think maybe it switches to the more trust-based model as soon as people realize a human or some humans made this. But it's also like, this seems to me like a radically different way of putting games out there in ways that are both obvious and maybe less obvious, in terms of the focus on trust and care and humanity.
Yeah. It's not that strange. I think that the hostile people you see, like hostile gamers.
Yeah, I should say a running gag here is that I keep saying I'm going to bleep the word gamer, like no other word, but just that. But yeah, no, totally. Yeah. I know what you mean. The capital G gamers. I gotcha.
Yeah. It's terrible. But anyways, like those people I think you think that there are more of them because they're just so vocal,
Loud, but
most of the people that play games are just generally nice people.
And just people who play games. Yeah.
Yeah. But they wouldn't post a review like, oh, I like this,
Right. That's it. Right. Like the reviews are mostly very passionate people. So they're advocates. They're people who like have their identity wrapped up in liking a thing, which can be fine. Yeah. Or they're people who are angry or trolling or review bombing or whatever. So you're right. User reviews and such don't usually reflect most of the people who enjoy a thing, who simply enjoy it and then maybe recommend it to a friend or maybe just move on.
Yeah, exactly.
That's an interesting thought too. That hadn't occurred to me in quite those terms, that your way of working appeals to the, like it's I was going to say populist, but populist obviously has political connotations, right? But it appeals to a broader swath of people as opposed to messaging everything and catering to a very loud, numerical minority of grumpy capital G gamers.
We've actually, we've seen a few cases where those type of people did find out about us, and it was not pretty.
Well, I mean, it's not hard to imagine what they would say, right? That like this is, you know, like
we found it very funny actually, but we've always figured like, oh, once we go to Steam, people are gonna hate us because we make small experimental stuff, and we would just flood the Steam pages, you know, or Steam libraries, and the games would be broken or whatever. But that's not
no, I mean, for starters, Steam is such a bizarre open space at this point that, like, even the most broken sock pop game is not the thousandth most broken game on Steam. You know, like, there's all kinds of janky stuff out there, to the point that Valve, who really hate doing any kind of manual moderation, you know, cracked down a bit on what they call fake games. You know,
yeah. Oh, but it's been. I understand what you mean. And I think we were also scared that we would get a lot of negative feedback at some point in time. But I suppose we found out that doesn't really happen. And that most people are just nice people.
That's honestly quite lovely. Like, that's really, especially, you know, again, at the historical moment we're in, just to remember that basically you can make art and people can enjoy it. And it doesn't have to be more complicated than that, at least in circumstances where an artist and an audience find each other. That's great. That's really hopeful and kind of beautiful, honestly.
Actually, I remember that Ruben said something. He noticed that whenever there was someone that would send us a message or an email that they were angry about, I don't know, anything in our game that wouldn't work, whatever, they would have whenever they would have an angry, how do you call it? They would sound angry in text.
Sure, an angry tone or something.
Yeah. And whenever so what he would do is he would just respond nicely, and 9 out of 10 times that other person would respond nicely as well. So it was just like an angry blurt.
It was I think it was either Zach Gage or Bennett Foddy, someone at the same GDC, maybe even in the same room where you guys did your talk, where they said not only, you know, would the reaction then be nice, but they'd be sort of embarrassed or even like mortified that they had been jerks before.
So we found out that as well, like, oh, that's how this works. And people are super nice when you're being nice to them.
Imagine that. Yeah, because that's it, right? I mean, like, there's two aspects to it, I think. I think if you're used to only playing AAA games, then there is sort of hostility in both directions. Like, AAA games can be a bit hostile to the player in some ways, you know, in terms of wasting your time or microtransactions or just like, you know, manufactured anxiety around spoilers and having to play it week one or whatever. There's all these ways in which, from a marketing perspective, they're literally deploying negative emotions to get people to engage in the game. But then it's also like they're used to icy silence when they reach out for support or like a form letter or something. Right. So realizing, A, this is just a person making art and I'm, you know, I can just like it or not. And that's the end of it. And then B, if I reach out for help, the person wants to help is such a like radical. It's weird, but it's such a radical shift for some people's thinking in terms of how they interact with games and game developers that it can really. Yeah, totally. People can turn on a dime, I think.
Yeah.
It's interesting. You have been super generous with your time. Do you need to get going?
Yeah, I mean, I do.
That's
need
all
to.
Good.
It doesn't really matter.
I heard both a yes and a no there.
What day is it anyways?
Today is Wednesday. It's totally cool if you need to go. No worries at all.
If you want to talk about anything, but otherwise, yeah.
I did have one more question, which was, I've made a good faith attempt here to talk not just about how you make games, but about the games themselves. And even so, I don't know that I've necessarily done a great job. Do you ever sort of get frustrated with you know, media outlets, you know, myself included, to whatever degree I'm the media, focusing on the sort of novel way that sock pop works and not enough on the work itself, which is, after all, the point and really interesting in its own right?
I don't think I get frustrated with it. You know, it's actually always nice when people think what you do is cool. So that's not a problem.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
But we have struggled with, like, going forward, we were talking about what we need is not other developers appreciating what we do, even though that's nice. What we need is people playing our games. And right now, that's mostly our audience is mostly people that also play games, also make games. I guess it's more of a struggle and not a frustration, because what would be nice is if a bunch of YouTubers or streamers would play a specific game because of that game, and it would sell more, I suppose. Obviously, that's what you said. That doesn't happen because most people, when they talk about us, it's more about the whole thing. And now, 2 years later, people don't really talk about it as much anymore because it's not really novel at this point anymore, maybe.
Yeah, it's less novel, but it's still not the norm. It's not even like one of the top three ways you think about independent developers sustaining themselves, you know? So it's like, you're right. Like, nobody's going to get clickbait out of just describing what you do and then moving on, because people aren't going to be like, wow, that's mind blowing, right? Like, they're aware that it's a thing. Yeah, exactly. Whereas, you know, the Brian Gilbert, is that the Polygon guy who featured you guys, right? And that was sort of like a big spike in your Patreon. Like, it was very, very novel then. But I think the other thing about his piece was it was sort of about shifting the expectation of people who play games, that they're not necessarily going to play a polished thing for, you know, 4 or 6 or 10 or 100 or 1,000 hours, but they, you know, that it's okay to have an appetite for quick experimental experiences. I think maybe that's something a lot of people who play games don't think about too much, you know, because they're maybe caught in sort of a consumer-y mindset where it's about like how much bang am I getting for my buck or something, or that it simply never occurred to them, right? Like they think I'm going to invest in a game I like a whole lot. So it's like that I think is, to me, what makes the way you work still worth talking about. But I hope you don't feel like that was at the expense of talking about the actual work, because I mean I was replaying Featherfall last night and I had a blast. It's you just
oh,
make
oh I'm so glad.
over and above how you make them, you just make really good games, the four of you gents.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks for playing. Featherfall especially is one of my favorite projects that I worked on.
I think it shows. There's not that any of the Sock Pop games don't have love in them, but that one has a ton of love. Like it's I think there's huge value in seeing a popular thing like Soulsborne Hero or whatever we're calling him or whatever, and deciding what you like and what you don't. It seems to me that what the Sock Pop games do is something that all indie games kind of do, which is, you know, cut off the cruft. You know, you don't have to have the giant cinematics and all the expectations from the AAA world. You can just make what's interesting. And I think Featherfall is like a super good example of that.
Yeah.
That wasn't a question. It was just a compliment. But anyway,
thank you so much.
Yeah. And thank you again for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. If you'd like to come back sometime,
no problem.
I would absolutely love to have you. I will obviously link to the Patreon and to all of your games and the collectives games and all of that. Anything else you wanna plug or put out there before we wrap up?
No, not really. You know, stay safe.
Yes, absolutely. That definitely stay safe. Cool. You are amazing. Thank you again for talking to me. And
thanks for having me.
Totally. Have a really good night.
Yeah, you too.
Bye.
Bye.
And that's the show. You can find most of Sock Pop's games on Steam, you can find all of them at sockpop.itch.io, and you can find their Patreon at patreon.com/sockpop. Speaking of Patreons, if you love the show and want to support it, and can afford to right now amid the craziness, and or if you support the Sock Pop Patreon and just can't stop patronizing Patreons, you can patronize this show at patreon.com/etao. Thanks very much to all of our current patrons, and a very special thanks to our newest $5 an episode patron, Lucas Cosen. If I said your name wrong, despite your thorough instructions, then I owe you another shout-out as well as an apology. The Everybody's Talking at Once podcast is hosted and produced by me, Drew Messenger Michaels, with co-collectivity from Francis Michelle Lopez and Lucio Valentino. Our logo is by Aaron Perry Zucker, using icons from the Noun Project, and you can find the show wherever you get podcasts. Presumably you have at least one place to do so since you're listening to a podcast right now. You can also find everything we do at etaopod.com, and I'll see you in 2 weeks when I will be talking to Sean Alexander Allen about the rather excellent Treachery in Beatdown City. Until then, take care of each other, take care of yourselves. See you soon, everybody.